share with them.
Fair enough. Hey, it's actually something that I picked up from one of your, on your, I think it's actually on the Catalyst website, when it's like you manage training, travel, recovery, and mental acuity for the biggest demands of these races. And in speaking, we've been doing this podcast for probably, I don't know, maybe a couple years now. And the travel aspect always comes up from pro riders that, for me as an amateur, I don't think of. Like, it's just me on the weekend, you know, like my travel yeah. problem is like, oh, I got to leave on Friday night. I come home Sunday night. Like, damn, that sucks. But not the, how, where are we riding in between? And this travel takes 3 days, and then like things go crazy and they lose the kits and the luggage. And like, so yeah, I think there's a lot more to that, that when we're not involved in it, we have no idea like how much you guys have to put on into that for the team. So
yeah. Yeah. It's definitely stuff to think about. I mean, yeah, I mean, luckily with the team, it's like a big organization and a lot of people have been doing it a long time. So there's a lot of just small tweaks to things that experientially now people know work pretty well for most people. So it's a good place to, it's been a good place to learn some of that skill set, probably more than it has been to like show that skill set. But yeah, I think in terms of the performance equation, sort of like the travel component and just, yeah, how do you minimize stress and maximize energy around any athletic event is pretty worthwhile in terms of performing well on the day.
I mean, is that as simple as just thinking, how do we get athlete A and B from point A to the point B in the least amount of time in the most direct way? Or like, what other variables are you
kind of looking at? There's for sure that one of the things we've talked about a bit and tweaked a bit over the past couple of years that I've been with the team in combo with the medical team is sometimes instead of just getting someone out of a race as quick as possible, like say race ends Sunday night, 5 day stage race, could be at the airport by 8 or could be at the airport by 6, 8 PM flight, they're home by 10, whatever, is like actually changing that somewhat depending on the flights that are available, picking certain times and riders to just commit to, like, they could leave the night of the race but spend the night in the hotel, have a good dinner, have a good sleep, fly out kind of mid-morning the next day, because at that point it's not so much about maximizing that race but it's about minimizing chance of illness off the back of that race, you know, because then maybe they have a week without racing and then another race in a week. And same right. thing kind of getting to the race, you know, like the flight looks good, but does it mean they're waking up at 5? And could that be a bit different? Like, do you want to avoid waking up at 5 the day before a race? And I mean, it's not stuff that always fits in, but yeah, it's stuff we've talked about and sort of comboed with like the logistics team of like extra factors to consider when thinking about flights compared to like what you said, just point A to point B as quick as possible.
Does that change rider to rider? Like, you know, that like some, like I'm thinking of, there's a book, Why We Sleep, and they're talking about how there are early morning people and there are night owls. And so maybe rider A is like, oh, I'm good with the overnight flight or whatever. And other people are like, no, dude, I go to bed at 8:30. Like, I can't be up at the airport at 9:30. Like, so does that change, or is it kind of like that's just getting way too granular with it?
It probably does change in the ideal world. It's definitely more granular than we actually like operate in real time, you know, like when the doctors have talked about it from a health prevention, like a sort of illness prevention standpoint, it's basically regardless of any sort of like sort of chronotype, like, are you a morning person? Are you a evening person when you go to bed? It's more just down the idea that regardless of whether you are more of a night owl or not, you'd maybe do better. Like, you finished a hard 5 hour race, you're maybe a bit immunosuppressed, a bit behind on carbohydrate. Pretty much everyone should do better just like not going into then like that big public exposure environment that is like an airport and travel, you know? So more of like an avoidance standpoint.
Cool.
Like, give them an overnight to recharge.
I like, can I like keep this in the podcast? I find this super interesting. I think other
sure,
people
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Like, we usually just kind of just start it rolling. So that'll be the, That's kind of the intro. Well, we'll do the quick intro. Like, for people that don't know who this is, Nate Wilson, let me allow you to introduce yourself. Who are you? Who you've mentioned that you work with EF, and yeah, just give a quick 30-second blurb.
Sure. Yeah, I work with EF. I'm a performance manager there, which entails training riders directly and also managing all the training camps we do with the team. And then I also do some work outside of the team, mainly with some triathletes and also with some cyclists. But that's really where I started, and then started working with EF late in 2019.
So you're pretty much fully EF. That was going to be one of my questions for like context to some of your answers. It's mostly working with the World Tour athletes, and then you just have like a few amateurs that you work with on the side currently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, really, like, EF is my full-time job, and then it's sort of like for portraying it well, it's basically like maybe doing some extra coaching on the weekend here and there.
Cool. What has been the biggest difference in, and you guys who are listening, you know, look up his website, Catalyst. You can get some more information about Nate. Nate has raced a couple years pro. He coached the U23 team for USA Cycling. Like, he has a ton of experience that he didn't just mention. One thing, what's the difference, or what's one of the biggest differences in coaching World Tour athletes versus the amateurs that when you were growing Catalyst coaching, besides the fact that, oh, these World Tour riders are way faster. What are kind of like the personality differences, or how they approach training, or like what kind of jumps out when I ask you that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think, like, you know, like all the same personality differences that exist in like a workplace or in school, like also exist within the team. You know, we have like a team of 30 athletes. So it almost feels harder to say the personality differences that exist between, say, like a pro level athlete and an amateur level athlete, because I think you see the same thing. You know, you meet amateur level athletes that have kids and work a ton, but like they're basically very professional attitude about their training. Like, they really work hard to get it done. They work hard to like think through planning it, and like set themselves up to execute it in like a very organized way. And almost like most people that are like that, I think it's because their mind just works that way to some degree. It's almost like it would be more anxiety inducing to not be that sort of like active in thinking about it than not. So it's like there's those riders, but then there's also the ones that are like, I mean, no one's lazy. No one can be lazy and be performing at that level, but just more like laid back, you know, like they check their training like at 9 a.m. while they're having breakfast, like over, and then like maybe realize like, ah, today's an easy day, or today's 5 hours. And I think you have the same thing in the amateur athletes, where it's like, you know, their sport is important to them and that's why they do it. But at the same time, the biggest thing is that it's kind of like fun. And yeah, they're not spending like the night before, like routing out the ride and like really thinking about what they're going to do. But I think the big thing is like, you just have more time. I mean, it's their job. So like most mm-hmm. people work 40 hours a week. They don't necessarily ride the bike 40 hours a week. Maybe they ride the bike 25 or something, but it's also like they have the time in their day. So there's things you can do to make those 25 hours of sort of active work go better. And they actually have the time to do it. So they should do it, you know?
They should. What percentage, sorry, I'm curious, what percentage do you think actually take advantage of that? Like doing all the little things, the foam rolling, the stretching, the core, the this, the that.
I think at this point, most, to be honest, maybe not 10 or 15 years ago even. But at this point, like every year, the level's getting higher and higher, and it feels like the races are getting harder, and like everyone sort of feels a bit that pressure. So in some ways, I think there's almost more pressure to do the extra stuff, almost to a negative degree, that sometimes it's easy to lose sight of like, well, at what point does like doing all the extra stuff I'm trying to do turn into a detriment just because I'm doing too much stuff? And I should just be taking a nap at that time or something, or just thinking about something that's not cycling, so I've got a bit more mental energy. But no, in general, I think the culture at the moment is like at the World Tour level of the sport is that like the job and the training looks like so much more than just getting on the bike and riding. It is, like you said, it is the foam rolling, it is the gym work, it is like taking an active thought to your nutrition, not just from weight management standpoint, but like, am I fueling well enough to do this training really hard? You know, periodizing the nutrition, like, is this a high carb day? Is it a low carb day? You know, being organized so you have good timing of food intake afterwards. You know, how's my sleep? Should I be using a wearable device that gives me feedback on my sleep? It's like there's almost so much you could grab at that. I think the challenge becomes like knowing that we should do a bit more than just the pure basics, because probably it can make most athletes better, but also like, how do we like narrow down the filter? Because otherwise I think it's super overwhelming, you know, or you don't stick with anything long enough to like try and actually evaluate if it was helping or not, or because you're always operating in a, like a really messy field.
You could do 10 hour days of stuff, like go ride 4 hours and then do that. Like, yeah, I mean, there's just, you got to pick and choose. You brought up wearables. Where are you at with those? What's your thought on wearables?
Yeah, I mean, I've had mixed experiences with them. And I mean, it's getting to be a broader and broader category. So it depends a bit. Because I mean, I know, like, I feel like I've been exposed to things like wearables like Moxie with like the muscle O2 saturation for, I remember that quite some years ago, like I want to say 10 or more, maybe. That's not something I use at all, so I don't have a strong opinion on it. But I guess the more popular wearables that like a lot of people are using, like the Whoop or an Oura Ring, kind of like a recovery type wearable or some sort of low-key sleep monitor. Yeah, I think they can be really interesting, maybe on a couple levels. I'm personally not to the degree of like, because I feel like I remember when they first came out, there being kind of a school of thought to start moving training prescription more to almost sort of like a daily or every couple of days sort of checkup of like, what's your HRV? What's your resting heart rate? That's going to tell us what we can do. I guess for me, I feel like I find the most benefit of it as sort of like a confirmational check, or just a bit of a warning signal that maybe we should check in on like, how are you feeling? Like, are there extra things we're seeing that don't look good? Like kind of a warning flag when we're doing the training that I kind of would want to prescribe anyway. So I like it. I like looking at the HRV, the resting heart rate, the sleep data. And I think the longer and more consistently you collect it, the more valuable it becomes, because like, I think there's plenty of error in the devices that it's hard to operate on like a small scale and live with it day by day. But if you commit to using it for say 12 months or 6 months, I think you should build up a big enough body of data that you start seeing trends that can be more likely to be worthwhile to react to, whether it's signaling illness or a longer term fatigue and things like that. So yeah, I like it. I think there's definitely a place for it. I think there's a ton of individual interpretation in terms of how you want to use it or not use it. And I think it probably depends a bit on the athlete, because like we've seen in the team, there's plenty of athletes that can collect that data, even observe it and like just sort of take it in as like another piece of the picture and use it quite constructively. But then there's other athletes that it's almost like it's almost too anxiety inducing to know. Like you might wake up and feel rested, but then when you check your app and it tells you actually you didn't sleep well, which could be wrong. I mean, I think there's some good research on a little bit debating some of the accuracy of some of those devices in terms of a sleep monitor. So, but then having that information being like something they just didn't need to know. You know?
Right. Yeah. It like psychs them out a little bit. It's, yeah.
I mean, like we also talk a lot in the team about how like we're doing a sport where inherently like you're going to be tired, like stage racing, you're going to be tired, training hard, you're going to be tired. So it's sort of like we're trying to like tease out like this is a useful feedback mechanism, but also like to what degree do we need to react to it towards? Like, like everyone would get, have sort of poor fatigue and recovery scores, I think wearing a wearable device over the course of a grand tour, but also maybe still be performing at quite a high relative level as the race goes on. So it's also like not necessarily actionable information.
That's the word, actionable, because that's the biggest thing I've had an issue with those of some of the data looks really cool. And to your point, some of the data they're saying is like, well, maybe it's not as exact as we're saying, but I never could take action. And because of those days where there's a discrepancy, you go out and set a PR and it's like, you're tired. It's like, no, man, I'm good. Like, I need to ignore you. You're holding me back a little bit. So yeah, I think there's pluses and minuses. It's not going to be perfect, but no, it's really interesting to hear your thought about that, having such a vast, kind of like really high level athletes to work with and see kind of what they're collecting data wise. And you get to see these, I always am envious of, you know, people being able to go do long stage races for obvious reasons. Amateurs don't get to do that. I think I've done maybe like a 7-day and I'm just like, man, this is so cool, but we don't get to, you know, it's very few and far between. So speaking of metrics, let's jump into some of like what I consider basic questions, but they come up all the time. And I'm really curious what you think. And if your answer changes based on amateurs or pro riders because they're riding more, maybe denote that. But okay. The thing that I'm always curious is, what do you prescribe workouts by for heart rate, power, RPE, maybe a combination? And I know that's kind of like a big question, but one that I get all the time is, how should I ride zone 2? So maybe we start there. What's like, how do you prescribe endurance rides? Yeah, we'll leave it at that.
For me, it's definitely a combination. Like I kind of like to work off of a zone that would be either heart rate or power based or a bit both, and almost have RPE be this thing that the athletes try to consider that maybe dictates where they sit in the zone, or as a bit of like a confirmation, or at least just something to think about, so they have a bit of like internal awareness. But for me, like endurance stuff, after the off season, like they take a month off or a few weeks off, or after an illness or a change in environment like heat or altitude, it's always straight to heart rate. So then we do everything by heart rate, because like my idea is, well, I think a lot of people's ideas, but is that power is sort of the output, but heart rate is the internal effort. So like we're trying to train at the correct internal effort. When you're in good shape, you might get one power, and when you're at bad shape, you might get another power, and when it's hot, it's a different power, and this or that. So I do think, like, for the most part, everyone's so oriented towards the power meter that I definitely just would use it. But for me, like anytime we're sort of in a point where it feels like there's change or a lot of external factor, just use heart rate. And then as the fitness builds and things kind of like even out, you know, and you're starting to build the base, then I would say a bit more like you can just go a bit more by the power, and then almost use heart rate more as a ceiling. Like here's your power zone, but say it's 200 to 250. That's 200 to 250, but with a max heart rate of 150. So if you're riding 220 and your heart rate's 150, then that's sort of enough for that day.
How would you have athletes set the zones by heart rate? Because is it okay for someone to say, okay, like 60 to 70% max is endurance. When I start getting up towards 80%, I'm probably more like tempo-ish. I know 90% is what people talk about as the like lower level of quality VO2 max work. Is having those as sort of stepping points okay, or do they need to do testing, or kind of how in depth do you get on that?
Yeah, I think the tricky thing is like getting correct max heart rate data could be tough. I almost think that if they wear a heart rate strap enough and do enough sort of racing or hard riding, then getting correct sort of threshold type heart rate data isn't that hard. So like personally, I usually set the heart rate zones off of just like a highest 30-minute heart rate and different percentages of that. And then for anything that's sort of, I really would use the heart rate for sort of threshold, below threshold or tempo or how you want to call it, and sort of zone 2 endurance stuff and recovery. And then anything above that, like I wouldn't really prescribe VO2 max work by heart rate. So then at that point, I almost just don't worry about like, you know, is the zone 90% of your max, you know? Not that there's not that you can't. I think for me it's more that, like, you know, heart rate's a reaction to an effort, you know, like we all know that from like training with heart rate and power simultaneously. You know, you hit a hill and you start riding harder and you see the power change immediately, and your heart rate changes as well, but like your power changes instantaneously and your heart rate's slowly going up. So I think trying to do VO2 to max work by heart rate, like if really what you're trying to do is kind of hold the power as steady as possible at the right intensity, I almost think you're better off doing that by sort of RPE and trying to develop that intrinsic sense of feeling and internal awareness that you kind of can feel the change in effort or the drop. Because I think if you're trying to react to heart rate, probably what the power file would end up looking like is like, say you did a 4 minute effort. I think you have like a big increase in power for 90 seconds to 2 minutes. And then you see power heart rate start to stabilize. And then the power actually just starts to drop and heart rate kind of stays high. But you probably actually overshoot the zone and then undershoot the zone, when like realistically, maybe you want to be trying to spend 4 minutes almost all in that zone or something. So for me, like if you don't have a power meter, I would almost rather do VO2 stuff just purely by RPE, and then maybe check the heart rate as sort of a reaction, you know, like was your heart rate getting up, you know, what's that?
I lost you. I think your things made it, they might have died.
Okay.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, better.
You're back. Yep.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Was it a long time that
No, just when I went like this. It just went out. Okay. So just how when like the heart rate is staying steady or climbing, and then at the like ending the 4 minutes, your power is slowly going to come down, and you're really trying to stay in that power band for the whole 4 minutes. So I think you completed the thought from where at least it sounded like you did.
Cool. Yeah. No, that's it. Anything else is just rambling.
No, I love it, dude. These are like, this is amazing. I have a bunch of questions with that. Actually, do you have specific VO2 max workouts? So if you're doing them by power mostly that you like to prescribe, or are there a few that are kind of like your bread and butter that you just think athletes really do well with? Are you like a 40-20 guy very often? Are you more of like a constant power guy? Are you hard start? Like what's your
how do
you decide for each athlete, I guess?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, I don't know if I know 100% how I decide for each athlete. It's definitely something that I feel like I'm still, you know, playing around with at times and refining. I mean, I've got a few thoughts on it. Like, I think that the 40-20s, I use them a lot, and I think they're great for a few things. I think they're great for accumulating time and zone, you know, in a way that's relatively low stress. If you want to just kind of shoot to bank time in that VO2 zone because you believe that's going to elicit a good adaptation, but you don't really want to work too hard either because of like where the workout falls, or like in you're almost like going a little bit this direction of doing more VO2 work in a preseason type phase rather than like really sharpening up for races and stuff. I think there's some good school of thought around just like time and zone creates a bit of a bigger change instead of just higher power. You know, it's like, are you better off doing 4 times 2 minutes at 450 watts or 6 times 2 minutes at 420 watts? They're like, you know, say they're both over, say the person's threshold is 380, they're both kind of in that VO2 space. One of them you do more time and zone, one of them you do more power. But I think in terms of improving VO2 max, probably larger time and zone is a bigger impact. So I think the 40-20s are like a great way to spend a lot of time and zone, but also have it be not too hard if you're kind of doing them not as like best effort, you know?
Okay.
So then it's something where it's like you can put in a period where you say, let's do a lot of time in the zone, but I don't really want you to like have a super high RPE for this session, you know? And maybe even have the benefit of having it be a bit more intermittent, so you're practicing a bit more of that pace change. I think for me, that's one way I use the 40-20s.
Let me jump in there real quick. So would you, when you're saying it's a lower RP, because I hate 40-20s because I think they're very hard. Would you have them do the 40 as the over, would you have those as like 120% FTP, or how do you pick the number? Like they're not going full gas then, or?
Exactly, not full gas. So I'd shoot for like 110 to 115% of FTP, but maybe do like three blocks of 10 or something, which would be 20 minutes in the zone, like so 10 times 40, 400, 1200. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool. Keep going. Sorry. Because someone will email me that and they're like, can you reach out to Nate and get the exact example? So I just start to ask them right now.
Yeah. And I mean, that's something where like I'd maybe move it up over time or something. Right. But, you know, if we wanted to do some 40-20s in the winter because we thought like, okay, we want to build your base, but it also almost feels like you need to improve your VO2 max. And like if we want to improve a lot, we probably need to stretch that out over a longer period of time. Like, I don't really think the answer is like say you would do 8 weeks of base work, then start doing a bit more intensity. And you say, oh, if we really think you need to improve your VO2 max, and you say, we're going to have this 4 weeks where we're going to do intensity. I don't really feel like I've found the answer to that is instead of doing one VO2 max workout a week, you do three. I think then you almost just flood the engine and you don't necessarily have time to respond. I think a more realistic approach is maybe stretch out the duration over which you expose to the stimulus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you want to still be cognizant, I think, of what the overarching goal for that sort of training period is. Like,
mm-hmm.
if you want to build a base, then you need to build a base. And in general, like, the work needs to be low intensity and higher volume and, you know, all the things that sort of we've always correlated the base training. Mm-hmm. I think you can have some exposure to VO2 work in that period without like ruining your chance of building a base, but then it needs to be really controlled. The frequency of it needs to be maybe somewhat low, that kind of thing. So also like the rider's in a little bit not good shape compared to their best. So also like mm-hmm. to be productive, the workouts need to be approachable. So yeah, I think these sort of like 40-20s in a period like that can be like a great way to like build up fitness, and just rather than expanding power, you're trying to expand time and zone. So it's like mm-hmm. rather than it's 3 times 5 minute blocks of 40-20s best you can do, it's 3 times 5 minute blocks of 40-20s that's something you can definitely do. And then you're doing 3 times 10 and 3 times 12, and you've built up by the time you get to February, you've built up a pretty decent amount of exposure to that zone. And like, maybe you haven't done that like all out for 5 minutes or something, but it's also you're comfortable pedaling that power. It's quite mm-hmm. repeatable. And I think you've gotten some pretty big max aerobic stimulus from that.
So to clarify, so you brought up base work. So you would have them maybe do this like once a week during base. And then when you're talking about extending the time beyond the go 3 to 10, 3 to 12, whatever, then they're maybe doing more sessions during the week as they get in, like before the races, maybe a month before or so.
Yeah, I've gone that direction before for sure. It's not something I'm always doing. I think a lot depends. You know, that's something where I definitely think there's a difference between the pro riders and the amateur riders, because mm-hmm. the pro riders in a normal healthy season, they race so much, you know,
yes.
70 to 80 days of racing a year. So it's like, they're not often in the position where we're saying like, oh, it feels like you're missing exposure to intensity and we need to like catch a little bit of that up.
Mm-hmm.
But like some experiences where I have used it and felt like it worked was like, people coming off of injuries where it's like they didn't get the normal race season, and you're like, well, you're on track for a normal race season next year, so like, you know, trying to simulate a race season over the winter just so you didn't not have a race season isn't the right thing to do. Like, we still want to follow this maybe, or I still want to follow this maybe more or less linear path of building a base in a traditional way and then adding a bit more intensity as we get closer to the season. But you don't really have that exposure to this consistent high volume of intensity from racing over the previous 12 months as you've had in past years. So we want to make up for a little bit of that, but make up for it in a way that's realistic, not going to like break down building a base and like is going to be achievable, you know, and not leave you like mentally in a puddle.
Well, you bring up a really good point about the quantity of racing, because, and not saying this negatively, I think the coaches at your level that are so engulfed in the world tour lifestyle that when they're tweeting things out sometimes that all of us amateurs are reading, it's like they forget how much these guys and girls race and how much intense, how hard these races sure. are. That I'm like, wait a minute, we're amateurs that are racing maybe every other weekend. Like, we're not getting these 4-day stage races, and we're not like, so it's just sometimes so hard to tease out like the best practices. Cause I think that even the people preaching it, they're not trying to be misleading. They just sort of forget like we're in totally different worlds of types of scheduling of our events and training. So you bringing that up is really, I think, an important point for us all to kind of like resonate with. I did it to myself this year for my own racing, like just way too much low intensity. And then, I won't get into it, but it's just, it maybe would work for pros at a certain point, but when you're racing a few times a month, it's just a different ball game. So
yeah, that's the thing. I think quite often like the pros were running into the issue of feeling like we did too much intensity. Like it's easy to get stuck in the trap of saying, oh, here's the races in these periods, so we should do some workouts that sort of mimic these races. But it's almost like if you've waited too close until the races start, then almost the stimulus is too similar and it's too close and you don't really have time to respond to it. And then you're getting heaps of that stimulus in the race. Or if you haven't started the races already fit enough, you know, the races are always intense. There's always intensity. They're hard in the early part. But if you haven't done enough intensity that you've moved yourself to a high level and you're just then doing a job where you're riding in the wind or chasing a breakaway on the front, you might be like, okay, well, I'm racing a lot. It's hard. I don't really have the energy to do much intensity between, or I know I need to kind of do some long, low intensity stuff to like maintain my base, but I didn't start the race period with a high enough level of intensity. Mm-hmm. So now I'm also like, it seems like I'm training it in the races, but like I'm dropped with an hour to go in the race. And then I'm just kind of riding in, and then like the almost like highest intensity part where people are like really attacking and like, then they're not getting it. And that's a bit where like maybe some of this, a bit more exposure to intensity in the winter and preseason can come from. Like you need a base, but at the same time, like the races are so hard now that like, and depending on, it depends a lot on maybe the individual rider calendar, but if the frequency of races is high enough that like really what you should be doing between is just recovering and then like some long, easy rides to keep up the base kind of, you don't really have the space to be like, okay, now in February is when I'm going to start adding in the VO2 max. Cause it's almost like you kind of already needed to add it, but if you added it, maybe you'll go from 95% to 100% because you're in the last hour of the race. And now you're doing these extra hard race efforts under fatigue. And you do get an extra boost, but sometimes I think we're seeing riders that start the season at 90%. Instead of kind of going from 90% to 100% over 4 to 6 weeks, it's almost more like they go from 90% to 85% because they just get fatigued. And then they'll go from 85% to 95% once they have a rest period. But it's not like with consistent racing week to week to week, they kind of just improve. It's more the guys that are already really good improving a little bit more for a bit, until they kind of like plateau and then eventually fatigue. But I think that's a big difference between how the pros and amateurs have to approach training, probably. Because the pros, it's almost like you're like, well, I know I've got all this stress that I've committed to, which is basically your race days. And then you're just kind of trying to figure out how to like work around it, hopefully that you don't get in the way, you know? Mm-hmm. Like that the number one job is that you recover and that you're like sort of generally aerobically fit enough that you can kind of keep going. Mm-hmm. And then like everything else is hopefully something extra you can add on top if you have the space. Mm-hmm. So I think in a lot of ways, like if you open up the training peaks of plenty of pro riders, a lot of them, it would look like very simple and not interesting and probably aspects of it applicable to amateur racers, but maybe a bit like you referenced of like, if you just took a basic training week that they might do sort of between races, it might be great in December, but it might not get you very far in terms of like improving to the demands of your races, you know?
Yeah, 100%. You bring up a really good point of that. If you're not fit enough to be at the end, you're missing out at the hardest part of the race when everyone's really throwing the biggest bombs because they're a little bit fitter. And I think I'm curious if you would agree with this. To boil this backwards a little bit, we could say for amateurs listening that I had a rider who is in a big metro city, has access to an amazing group ride, really hard. He's like cat three-ish, we'll say 3-4. And I started realizing, like, why is he not making it to this last sprint point? And he's like, well, I'm going guns blazing on the first one. I'm like, dude, forget the, who cares about the first one? If you win the first one, no one remembers you from like the first sprint. Like, you want to win at the end. And so I'm like, he's like, wait, so I should save energy? I'm like, use the first part of the ride to focus on your conservation. Like, this is part of your bike races, right? You don't, who cares how hard you pedal in the first hour? Conserve as much as possible. And then I won't call out other riders, but when like this cat one and this team starts doing their things, you want to be there so you can start to play and see how they actually race. They don't care about this first sprint point. Like, they want to win. I know this ride. They want to win that against their friends. So like, put yourself at the end, focus on the end. And then when you get through that, now go for the second and third sprint point. And then when you do well at that and you upgrade, and like we're talking 2 years down the road, now you're going first sprint, second sprint, third. Like, so I think having us amateurs think of always try to race where you're physically able at the hardest part of, whether it's a group ride or like race up sometimes. If you're a cat three, do the 1-2-3 race every once in a while. Don't always do the 3-4. Like, would you agree with that? Because it just gives you that, puts you in that area where you have to figure out, if you're not strong enough yet, you have to use your brain a lot more. But then you're also racing the hardest part of the race. Is that kind of what you're saying with what's going on with the pros? I mean,
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's definitely something to that. And like, there's definitely something to be said for like trying to get to the end and get like you're saying, like that front row seat to like where it all happens and like learn something there, you know? I mean, the beauty of like the pro team is like, you've got 7 guys at most races working as a team. So it's sort of like, it's more of a tactical thing than a coaching thing, but you know, for sure, some guys, their job, whether they want it to be or not, is to patrol the first part of the race so that somebody else can save their energy for the last part of the race. And then maybe there's another 2 guys whose job is that, like, if that person that's saving their energy missed something that they shouldn't have because they were saving their energy, well, now you've got these 2 matches to burn that aren't you, to try and chase it back together. So there's maybe a bit more, I wouldn't say it's easier, but they've got a bit more cards to play with than someone that's just thinking about, like, I kind of want to be smart, but also I got to do it all myself. But I think that's where you would learn the most. And I mean, that's the same process they all have to come through, of like racing at the junior level and racing at the under 23 level. And I think historically you end up seeing some of the smartest racers from guys that probably weren't super strong in those development moments, because then they really have to develop skill set and energy saving and tactics. So I think there's a huge part of that. And like, the athletes that make it to the top level sort of on physical dominance can then in some ways end up like under equipped when they're now on like a more level playing field.
Interesting. It's almost like the kid who hits puberty first and is just stronger than everybody in 5th grade, but then doesn't develop all the other things. Then like, people catch up to him. It's like, how are they not amazing still? So there's always, Well, you brought up internal awareness a little bit ago. And as someone who's ridden at a really high level, coaching really high level athletes, in working with a lot of amateurs, things like Zwift sometimes, and I think the trainer, there's, like, I hate Erg for Zone 2, because I'm like, just learn to control your power, learn more than just like robotically. And I know people push back on that for certain reasons. They don't have the time. They need to multitask, whatever. I'm like, okay, that's not the best for training, but can you talk about like internal awareness in training? And you kind of brought up when we were talking about VO2 max stuff. And I just think it's not it's not something that anyone really brings up very often. So when you talk about that, just kind of go in on that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'm, in one way, it's really simple. Like, to me, it just means how do you feel? But it also means, like, how do you feel? Like, you want to know how you feel so that you kind of know what you can do, which, I mean, can open up a whole can of worms of, like, overthinking and overanalyzing how you feel. And that's something that people run into. But I think, to me, a lot of it's about pacing. But I also think then the better you get at pacing, sometimes some athletes seem to realize, like, how much farther they can push themselves. So I think there's, like, pacing for conservation, but then there's also pacing to, like, really find your limits. I listened to a podcast with a Dutch coach, Louis Delhay. I probably say his last name wrong. But he's been coaching a long time. He worked with Jumbo for a long time. He coaches Annemiek van Vleuten, and he coaches quite a few triathletes. And he's really big on, like, sort of the polarized training model. And, like, he doesn't, like, ever prescribe intervals by power. Like, I think he has, like, three zones. It's, like, easy tempo endurance and high intensity. And, like, when he does high intensity, he would never say, like, you know, 4 times 8 minutes at threshold. He would say, like, 4 times 8 minutes all out, with whatever recovery between. But, like, what he means is sort of the best 4 times 8 minutes you can do. Yes. So it's like he would use the power, analyze it after. But, like, a part of what he said he is hoping to achieve by that is sort of help the athlete develop an awareness of pacing. So it's like the first time they do it, like, he gives them whatever, they have no guidance, and they might, like, totally blow up. Maybe they can't finish the workout, or the last rep is, like, really low, which sort of seems like, well, that's a bad way to write a training plan. It just leads them to, like, totally fail. But I guess the thing is, like, if you're willing to just commit the timeline to a bit of trial and error, then the athlete would develop the pacing basically because they have to. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of value in that, because then ultimately that's a bit what you need in racing. I mean, you don't really need anxiety around overthinking of, like, can I do it? Do I need to be more conservative? And there's plenty of reason to argue that that can get in the way, and, like, some level of internal awareness is too high and distractions are better, kind of thing. But I think, yeah, I mean, some level of that is really useful. I think, especially if you're talking about a solo event, like time trialing or,
Man, you've brought up how many nuances there are to training. And I don't know if I'm alone in this. I just think lately, in the past few years, a lot of people want everything so precise and, like, hey, here's the guidebook to becoming a better cyclist. And it's like, do this and you get this outcome. And it's just not that way. And so there's all these little, like, nooks and crannies to train, and you're really highlighting a lot of them. So I absolutely love this. With respect to your time, we've got probably like 8 minutes left or so. I think the other things that big bullet points I know people would want to hear about are, and you can kind of, I don't know how we want.
I'm also fine on, I mean, if you have something to do, no worries, but I'm fine on time. So, like, especially since I was late, I'm happy to go longer. It's not.
We'll do like another 20 minutes then, if that's cool.
Cool. Yeah, cool. That's great.
So another thing that I think has really been on people's radar and just kind of talking about the way they approach, if they want to increase their FTP for, I don't know, I want to say like 2010, if we went back to training, it's like you brought like 4x8, then you go 4x10. It was very constant power based. And then overunders kind of have really become more popular, at least on my radar, and maybe the past 3 or 4 years, everyone's into these. What's your approach if an amateur rider, or even, I guess, I mean, do world tour riders, they're like, hey, I need to increase my FTP this year. Their number's probably where their number's at, right? Like, what do you think of all?
Yeah, to some degree, it's interesting because, yeah, that's maybe a definite difference between, like, pro and amateur, where I feel like in the amateur world, it's a lot about what you talk about. You know, if your FTP goes up, like, things are going well. And, I mean, I think there's a lot of validity to that in, like, a few areas, you know, but in the pros, a lot of times it can either be, like, way more specific or way less specific, you know? And so, like, I think you've got certain riders that are thinking, like, you know, my threshold just needs to go up, you know? Like, I'm like, I feel good on long climbs, but I just need another 15 watts or something sustainable, which is kind of, the same as what, same as just saying your FTP needs to go up. But like a lot of it, I think, and this is maybe somewhere the over under stuff trickles down from, you hear a lot of guys talk about like, feeling like they can hold the power if they're in control and it's just steady, but it's not steady, it's always really hard for 4 or 5 minutes at the bottom, even if it's a half hour climb, and then it settles, and then maybe some people drop the wheel and you were too far back and you've got to make a surge to like stay in the group kind of. So I think there's a lot of like trying to translate even like, okay, you've got your FTP, but then like in races, it's almost like you could look at the file or the person could look down in the power meter and say like, yeah, I mean, like in training, I can do whatever, 400 for 20 minutes. And like, it's not easy, but I can do it a lot. And then in this race, we were just doing like 370. I got totally dropped. But like what they're not seeing or like, it's like every hoop you have to jump through before that moment at which you got dropped at 370. So it's not that like their FTP is way too low. It's more like the resistance to all this higher lactate efforts is a problem. It's like a lot of people can gradually raise their FTP, but if like if bursts over the top of it really put them into the red, then it's hard. So I mean, I think there's different ways to come at it from, but I think one idea that's kind of interesting is to look at like the relationship between like best 5 minute power and best 20 minute power, because like most people's best 20 minute power is gonna be some percentage of their best 5 minute power that's like 80 to 85%. And if that 20 minute power is a really high percentage of the 5 minute power, like 90 to 95% or something, they're probably just some, okay, either they just haven't generated the data, so that's like always something you can say, but let's just say like all the data is realistic. They're probably a bit more limited by like sort of their VO2 max, like their max aerobic ceiling, than their sort of endurance or like ability to sustain, and I think there's a bunch of different terms for it and different softwares where people look at it, different things, but that's the simple way how I think of it. Or other way around, if the 5 minute power is really high and the 20 minute power is really low, then they kind of good VO2 max, but like they're limited by their ability to sustain. And so I think then if you divide it up into one or two of those simple bins, you kind of can pick a direction that you need to focus on a little bit more if the goal is to raise FTP. So it's like, if you think, you crush tempo workouts and like your endurance is great, but like just like kind of can't get it higher, that person probably can benefit from a lot of VO2 work, maybe comboed with like some tempo or like long stuff, so you still maintain some duration. And then like back that out into like, okay, now let's practice a little bit, do some 20 minute efforts, kind of like 10 watts below your threshold, some that go over and above, because I think that's another interesting way to train VO2, because you mentioned stuff like, I call it broken VO2, like 40-20s, and like steady VO2, like 4 times 4 minutes or something. But I think that over-unders is another thing, like 3 minutes at 85% of threshold, and then 2 minutes at 110%. That's also, I think, pushing that ceiling up, but hopefully working a bit on sort of that ability to clear lactate whilst not going like totally easy.
Give me your percentages for over-unders again that you like.
Well, I think you could do them a lot of different
ways. Okay, like, would you just spit out?
I said 3 minutes at 85% and 2 minutes at 110%.
Okay, cool. So to make sure I have this clear, so when you're talking about the relation of 5 and 20 minute power, if the 5 and 20 are very close, meaning that they could do more VO2 max work, that's when you would go down the VO2 max, whether they're doing the 40-20s or the 4x4s.
Yeah.
And if it's farther away to the 80% number, then you would say, okay, let's work on FTP. And then you would decide whether you do over-unders or constant powers, you're saying, or use the tempo to keep the duration going.
Yeah, well, correct? A little bit. I think what I think of it more is like, if the end goal is raise FTP, the question is, what's your limiting factor in your FTP going up? is it your VO2 max or is it your ability to sustain? So I would look at the sort of percentage of 20 to 5 minute power to try and assess which it is. And if it's a really small gap, I would say we need to push the max aerobic ceiling up, because your ability to sustain is okay, but you're being limited by your max aerobic ceiling. So then we go more the VO2 max. But if it's a really low percentage, I would say you're being limited by your ability to sustain or your endurance. So then we would do more time training below threshold. You know, I guess I kind of think you don't really raise your threshold by training at threshold. It's a product of some combo of time spent above and time spent below and how good you are in both of those areas, and how they combine is sort of some equation that produces the power you can hold for 20 minutes. I think there's definitely some element of needing to practice that, like, you know, you could do a bunch of VO2 max work and do a bunch of tempo work and be like, oh, you know, percentage wise, I think, you know, what I could do for 20 minutes is about this. But if you haven't touched that power at all, I mean, some people are just great at it. It just comes to them naturally. Just sitting right on the power is what they're best at. And they don't need to ever do that. And they could, you know, jump on a climb and they're going to do that effort really well. Other people, I think there's definitely some degree of.
Just went out. Yep, it's back. Yep, you're back.
Okay, it's back.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever you click when you, like, maybe the mouse or something.
I don't know. Well, that was my headphone thing. Like, I just put one away, but I think most people don't improve their threshold by, like, you know, trying to ride at like 2 times 10 minutes at 98% and then 15 minutes. And I feel like that was really the school of thought when I first got into training. I first got a power meter in 2008, and that was really the school of thought then, you know, like 2 times 20. I guess a lot of like sweet spot work, which would be a little bit farther below threshold, but I feel like a lot of people did that. And to me, what I consider that now is like practice, or like I call it like familiarization. It's like you're familiarizing yourself with the ability to hold the power, because like you might physiologically have that ability, but like if you've never done it, if you haven't spent any time riding there, you know, it can feel weird and it can feel really uncomfortable. So I think if you did a max 20 minute test and then practiced a little more and 3 weeks later did another max 20 minute test because you'd done a few 2x20s at like 98% of threshold and you got a bit better, I don't really buy that like doing those 2x20s at 98% made you like physiologically that much more capable. I think it just helped you practice sustaining pretty high power and kind of being uncomfortable. I think it's more like this combo of like power above threshold, like max aerobic power, and sort of efficiency or endurance below threshold that really drive what your FTP is.
I love it. There's always a clip that it's like, someone's be like, dude, I think Brendan's paying this guy to say this, because I just, there's a lot of similarity in things that I talk about. And so I love to hear that from somebody like you that have a ton of respect for. What's the, okay, so that's really good. You actually brought up something about the over-unders I was going to ask you and just slipped my mind. But what are we talking about? Let's talk about strength work, actually. With, do you think people should be, or maybe I don't want to say it that way, do you find that athletes get benefit from lifting, or is it not worth their time? And if they're lifting, is it all year? Is it just in base period? How do you approach that?
I definitely find that they get benefit from lifting. Like what I like to aim for in the ideal scenario is that they build up a good enough foundation of lifting in the base period where, like, if they're carrying some soreness from gym work, it's not a huge detriment to the ride quality, because, you know, we're not super worried about that. My goal is that they adapt well enough to some level of work in the gym during that period, that then, say, it's what at whatever point they're traveling more or the intensity is ramping up, that they don't need to just completely step away from like the weights or sort of heavier gym work, and then they're only doing like core or body weight stuff. My hope is that they build up a strong enough foundation that we can kind of, as much as logistics allow, keep doing some level of weight work that then needs to be pulled back and periodized a bit more with like what the training's like, what's realistic logistically, but carry that like the whole way through the season. Because I think there's a huge benefit from it, from both like injury prevention, but also just like efficiency on the bike, and also power. So yeah, I think it needs to have a, like any sort of proper strength program probably needs to have a few different versions of it. And there's things to think about of like, when are you doing it in the week? When are you doing it in the day? What kind of training rides are you placing around it? And like all those sorts of variables that you can play with. But I think in the ideal world, you really carry it as a consistent part of your training.
Awesome. I love that. What a kind of shifting gears in the type of question, over the years, what have you learned about coaching or even cycling training, we could say, that's made you a better coach?
Yeah. It's quite a bit.
Go in on that. All the things that just entered your mind. I'm so
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, I feel like I make a ton of mistakes, you know? So I think like the biggest thing is, just like, I don't know, slow down and try and like look at the big picture. I think context is everything. Like I'm a really big believer personally that like kind of your base is everything. And as much as like we get excited and I get really excited about like new ideas, like using a bit, like getting a bit away from traditional models and using more intensity in the winter and, you know, VO2 max work more consistently through the year or something. And not just as something that we're getting into 3 weeks before races and eliciting changes that way. I kind of think like all of that is a great part of like hopefully advancing the training model a little bit closer towards what it can be, but it's sort of none of it matters without sort of the base and the aerobic efficiency. And you can definitely run too far the wrong direction with the base stuff and create so much fatigue that you're not realizing you're creating. And I feel like I've made that mistake and learned from it, that it's like a lot of that base work, like zone two or zone three tempo stuff, or, you know, high torque efforts, you know, like I call them SFR. But I think a lot of that work, the beauty of it is that it's repeatable under a relatively high load of fatigue. It's not like going out and doing 4 times 4 minutes and like you get this really clear feedback signal that you're too fatigued to do it because you literally couldn't. It's like you can carry quite a high load of fatigue through that. So it's like, I think you can definitely run too far the direction of you sort of like overbase yourself or like diesel out or whatever. But in general, I think that's sort of what I was saying before, that some of that stuff that I get excited about as like how to get really fast or do something kind of new and different, it's sort of like none of it matters if you don't have the base. None of it matters if like you don't have the consistency, if you're not healthy, if you don't have that like aerobic base built up, you almost just don't have like the stock in the bank to like perform those workouts and benefit from them. Mm-hmm. I feel like, so I mean, it's kind of stupid because I feel like that's like the basic thing that like everyone learns in coaching from the starting point. But I feel like for me, I always see so much, I mean, I guess we all do, like it's so easy to access ideas right now, but it's like you see so much stuff coming across your desk that's like exciting, and there's probably a lot of value in all of it. I think the hard decisions to make aren't like what training is possible. Like that stuff's easy. Like you can spend hours on Google and come up with like a million different ideas and they're all like really cool and great. It's more like how do the factors combine? What's the correct sequence of events? And I think a lot of that also depends on context, you know, like where's the health? How much have you been racing? It seems like you're limited in intensity, but if we actually zoom out and look at the whole thing, okay, you might be right. You're limited in intensity, but is training with more intensity going to help with that? Or have you just had a ton of exposure to that? And maybe actually there's a lot of stimulus that's been accumulated and you'll actually benefit from it. But what you need from it isn't more of it. It's a break from it, you know? And then, I mean, it's the same stuff we all know. It's like you create stress and then you have an adaptation period and then you improve. But like, I don't know, somehow it's really easy to lose sight of when you're like in the week or in the day. And Yeah, so I think just trying to like zoom out, see the context, prioritize building a base over everything. Everything is sort of a nice addition on top of that. Yeah, I feel like that's the stuff I always end up coming back to when I feel like I made a big mistake. I just sit there at the end of the year and I'm like, oh
I
man, I'm an
love your
idiot.
candor, man. This is incredible. With you hit on base, and not to beat a dead horse, but I know there's, and especially to a newer athlete that like right now they're listening to you and they're like drinking from the fire hose and like, oh my God, there's so much information in this podcast. Base training. We're going right into base training. What is the most, and you use the word basic a bunch of times, basic way for an athlete to approach base training? So yeah, I'm just gonna leave that there.
I kind of personally in my head break building a base into two phases. The
Okay.
goal of the first phase is to just adapt to training, like be able to train, you know? So for me, that's like gradually building training volume, doing lots of work in just zone one and two. So like basically easy conversational pace to slightly more moderate aerobic pace. And then incorporate lots of exercises that sort of lay groundwork in terms of neuromuscular recruitment or just like how you're able to ride the bike that are gonna let you train a bit more in the future. So for me, that's stuff like high cadence exercises, a little bit of like high torque, like low cadence exercises and sprints, you know? So the, and then that, like within that big box, that stuff can vary based on like, you know, the level of athlete, how much time they have to work with. What, like, are they hitting this base one phase after a month off the bike? Or is this just sort of like, can you actually almost rush through this base one phase because it's almost not necessary? Like, they're already coming in, like, able to carry good training load, you know, having access to a pretty big toolbox in terms of cadence and different things. And then for me, like, base two is more about like, increasing the training volume from sort of the baselines you built up to in the first phase, and then sort of increasing the level of aerobic work you're doing. So like if we were kind of just getting most more or less easy time on the bike, like now I'll start adding like quite a bit of tempo work. Same thing, dependent on all the same sort of relative effort for different athletes, but dependent on sort of time they have in the week, their level, that kind of stuff. Are we just doing the tempo work, or are we trying to do 5 hour rides with a half hour tempo in the last hour because we're also working on a fatigue resistance element. I think there's like same thing, a lot of directions you can go, but it's like the simple bin for me is like grow training volume, accumulate like grow volume of tempo that you can manage each week, do torque work, like low cadence work. I usually use like 3 to 5 minute blocks repeated, and do sprint work and build fatigue resistance.
What's the athlete's benefit from tempo? Because I know some people will be out there reading, they're like, I can't, they'll get the, is it no man's land? Is it that moderato? What do you think is the big benefit of the tempo for athletes in base?
Yeah. And I mean, well, I might not be right, you know, because there's plenty of people like saying, like, you know, get away from the tempo a little bit, go a bit more this direction, like fat max, which I think in terms of percent threshold, you could call like below 80%. I don't love the term fat max because like I kind of think you don't really know, you know, fat max is a metabolic zone. It's not a function of FTP. It's a function of the power at which you're literally burning the most grams of fat, which it isn't, it's not high intensity, but it's not easy. But sorry, that could be a different talk, but
I was
I
like, you're
mean,
opening up a
I
can of
think
worms
that,
here, Nate.
but I think that, like, yeah, I think the tempo stuff, I think you just build a lot of endurance, a lot of efficiency. I think mentally, you kind of build the resilience to just sustain, like, kind of be comfortable being uncomfortable. But it's also as long as the zones are set right, it's like a low enough stress effort that you can do a lot of it. You know, you can do 3 times 20 minutes and I mean, you need to build up to this, but you can do 60 or 70 minutes of tempo in a training session. And that's not like, if you're doing it right and you've kind of progressed up to it, that shouldn't be really hard. You know, you can do that twice a week without that killing you or bringing you on to be too fast too soon. So I think it just, yeah, makes you really strong.
Yeah, I think there's a big aspect of that strength work. And I had very old school mentors living in upstate New York, partly because of the weather outside, but we rode fixed gears. And so I was actually texting with the guy today. I'm like, what were we riding a 4217 all winter? And he's like, yes. And I was like, wow, that is why my legs always felt so strong coming out. I mean, and it's not, you know, we're in upstate New York, so it's rolling terrain. There's maybe like a 3 minute climb, a 5 minute climb here and there, but it's not like we're climbing mountains on this thing. Yeah. And I was thinking, geez, you know, I do some torque work. I've even been talking to my coach Landry about it. Like, it sometimes falls off for a lot of athletes, I feel like, after base. Mm-hmm. I've considered doing it throughout, and you just have that extra gear. And it's, I think that there's something to be said about the benefit of variety in training. And I think every zone is applicable, just not over prescribing something. And so it's this, because I've even had people that I really respect, like, oh, don't do tempo, it's too glycolytic. And so I'm like, wait, it's too, so I'm now burning more carbs.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
a bad sure. thing. I'm like, but I also want to be strong, like, and I'm going to be in a race. And I do agree at the same time that riding a threshold is not how you increase threshold. So it's just, I love what you say, context matters. And so it's like, where does this all fall into play with the training, the racing? And there's just so, this is what I love about coaching. I think when you start talking about context, it's like, you know, as we come out of spring, how big is the first three races to this athlete? And what's their mindset? Do they need to like get on the podium in one of these early ones, or they just get in their head and then they suck the rest of the spring? Or are they okay kind of like rolling into the season a little bit more? And the fifth race is their biggest race, and they're mature enough in their training and racing to know like, hey, I might get seventh in the first one. That's okay. And so just, yeah, you've brought up so many nuances that has been awesome to hear from you, because I just get emails that are like, I want like the guidebook. Like there's
yeah,
not a
yeah,
guidebook.
Sure.
And you're 2 years into training. Really well, you're so new, like just have some patience.
Yeah. I like what you said. A lot of every zone is applicable. It just sort of matters when or how, you know, because I think a lot of times that's like what people are kind of looking for these days of like, oh, I'm a tempo guy, or I'm a fat max guy, or like, you know, VO2 is the backbone of my training. And yeah, I think it's just, yeah, probably like variety and periodization and sort of a healthy rotation through a sort of phasing of training that builds well off of each other is good, you know, because that's definitely something I think we find. And I've found this, especially with triathletes, where they race a bit less, is like, it doesn't really work to like just be like you do base until it's not winter, and then you gradually build up. You know, you're trying to stretch out one 3-phase build over 6 months or something. I think the progress almost comes more when you kind of like cycle through maybe a little bit more frequently, you know? Yeah.
Awesome. Any questions that I might maybe have missed? I know I shot over quite a big list. Was there anything that you're like, ooh, I want to hit on this before we go?
I can take a look. I'm just scrolling through it. No.
Underrated, I mean, overrated. Anything underrated or overrated?
Well, it fits in a bit to one of your other questions. I think that carb restricted training is overrated.
Okay.
And I think that high carb training is underrated.
Oh, okay. I quickly hit in 60 seconds or less, high carb training. What do you mean by that? And why is it underrated?
I think from a high carb training is would differ a little bit on the athlete, but it's any training where you're trying to take in more carb than you sort of normally comfortably can, until you're to a point where you're kind of comfortably taking in, transporting, and feeling benefit from sort of these upper limits of the more updated guidelines of, say, 90 grams of carbs an hour. And I mean, some people are now having 120 an hour, but just leave it at 90. So I think that's a high carb training. And I think the reason why is that, like, most people, when they get dropped or the critical moment in a race, it's because they can't perform the intensity at that moment. And no matter how good you get at using fat, any high power effort it's driven by fueling by carbohydrate, because that's what produces the energy fast enough. Like, we like fat because we have a lot of it, but we're still limited in terms of the rate of energy turnover. So it's not useful for going fast. So I think that, like, it's attractive to focus on fat to help you have more carb. But with the way nutrition products are now, and if you've done the right training to, like, maximize your gut transport, you can take on plenty of carb. That saving carb is never really an issue, unless you're talking about true and ultra endurance sports. Then I think it's a different conversation. But for, like, most normal bike racing, I think sparing carb is never actually an issue. So I think you should be much more focused on maximizing carb intake, ability to transport, and ability to use, than on trying to save it. So, like, I'd rather way more focus on that side of the equation.
That's a mic drop. I was like, love that. Love that. Nate, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was incredible. So many gems. I know this is going to be one of those podcasts that people are like, oh, I had to listen to that 3 or 4 times to really get into it all. My last question, what's the best way for people to keep up with you? Do you blog, Instagram, Twitter? Like, what's the...
I have Instagram. Okay. Let me see. I need to look it up. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I'll put it in the show notes, and okay. I'll put in Catalyst Coaching also, and we'll put
your... Yeah, that's the one. Catalyst Coaching. It's Catalyst Coach. I just... do you want me to type it in really quick?
No, I got it. I think I'm following you. If not,
it
was...
yeah, that's it. I mean, I have a personal Instagram, but it's not really, like, worth anything related to coaching. It's pretty...
so
it's just these, like, stupid photos I put up of, like...
so if you guys want to be creepy and weird, you can follow his personal page. If you want to get cycling stuff, go to Catalyst, and I'm sure people are already following EF and all that. And so thank you so much for doing this, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon, and good luck with your training.